Good afternoon. So last time we talked about locks. We mentioned that, well, we need some way of coordinating our threads, making our threads take turns. And we also need to have that mechanism also tell the processor and the compiler, hey, other threads are doing things, and locks were our way of doing that. That was sort of more fine-grained than just the idea of we'll join a thread and wait for it to finish, which was the previous mechanism we had. And we said, well, once we had locks, we had a problem. And that problem was that we could get things hanging when we used locks. And we had this issue called deadlock, where we accidentally create this circular dependency. And deadlock was particularly annoying because this was almost pretty much always going to be the type of hang where it would only sometimes happen because it was very timing dependent. And therefore, the way we wanted to resolve it is kind of by planning ahead to make it so it wasn't possible. And we learned it came from these circular dependencies where one thread was holding some resources so another thread couldn't use it while grabbing some other resources. So ways we can avoid it, depending on our situation. So sometimes we can just not hold one resource while acquiring another. If we can avoid doing that, there's no possibility for deadlock or acquiring another, that might be shared. We can avoid, limit our sharing. We had this idea that something we can do is this abort and retry idea, where we just say, if I would wait to acquire a resource while holding another, instead I don't wait, I just check to see if I can get it, and if I can't get it right away, I just give up all my resources and start from the beginning. And this avoids deadlock because we needed that kind of hold and wait condition. This is a way of getting rid of that. And for locks, the most common way we actually avoid deadlock in practice is this idea of a consistent ordering. That in order to have that loop, we needed to have one thread acquire some A, then B, while some other thread acquired some B, then A, or something like that. We need to have some inconsistent order in which we acquire locks. So we can avoid deadlock with locks by acquiring all our locks in the same order every time. And it doesn't matter what that order is, it just matters that we choose and always make enforce an order. So questions about deadlocks and locks, since we're going to talk about things that are kind of more than just locks this time. Okay, so we're going to introduce probably three different tools that solve synchronization problems that locks don't really solve. And first, we're going to introduce a very specialized tool. Then we're going to spend some time on a very general tool called monitors. And then we're going to briefly introduce another general tool that we don't like as much as monitors. So the specialized tool we're going to introduce is one you're going to use in an upcoming assignment. It's called barriers. And to give kind of an idea of the use for this, so let's say I want to compute the minimum of a 100 million element array. And I decide I'm going to divide this up into two threads by having each of two threads, compute the minimum of 50 million elements. Then I'm going to wait for them to all finish and take the minimum of all the minimums. And we know a way of doing this. We've seen examples that do something similar where we just join the threads. But that's kind of disappointing because we'd like some way of waiting where the thread doesn't have to terminate, where the thread could continue doing other work. For example, maybe you want to take the minimum another time later on. So you want the threads still around, we don't want to restart the threads every time. So barriers are going to be a tool for implementing this wait for everything else operation. And they're going to have kind of two functions they'll implement. So we'll have an initialize function. We're going to tell the barrier object how many threads it needs to handle. And then we'll have a wait function, which all the threads that are involved in the system will call. And that wait function won't return until all the threads have called wait. So wait waits for everyone else. So the kind of idea here is that a bunch of threads do some work in parallel, then we have them all wait for each other to finish, and then we can go on to the next step. So with our parallel minimum operation, the way this might work is that we'll first set up a barrier with sort of initialized to use two threads, and then in our two different threads, we'll both have them both sort of compute the minimums, and maybe they'll do it kind of not quite at the same time. That's what I'm representing by having kind of a different, lines, staggered a little bit. But in this case, it seems like thread zero finished first. So this wait here, it won't return until thread one calls wait. So in that way, we'll be assured that the code later on in thread zero that takes the minimum value from thread one and uses it doesn't use an old, out-of-date, uncomputed version. It waits for thread one to finish computing it. So questions about this basic use of barriers? So far, this is kind of giving us something like pthread join, but without the thread exit. Where barriers are really useful is that they're really designed for a very common pattern we see in simulation type code, where we're going to want to have barriers that we use multiple times, and barrier support being reused. So as an example, let's say we are computing something like a weather simulation. So what we might have is results of time and place equals, the weather forecast at time, t in place p. So that might be what we're computing in our results array. And in a typical way you would do that kind of simulation, the way you compute the weather at time t plus one is by looking at the weather at time t in the current place and the places nearby. So in this case, I have two places computed by two threads. In a more realistic version, we might have like thousands. But the idea is that we sort of, when we compute the weather at time one, we need to have the information about the weather from basically all the other threads at the previous time step. So we better wait in between for those values to all be available before we move on. And when we compute the weather at time two, we need all the weather at time one, not just in the place we compute, but the nearby places. So we're going to need to have this wait to handle that dependency. So everyone needs to wait for everyone else after computing every time step. And this pattern comes up all the time in simulations, including the one we're going to have you do in a future assignment, where basically we want to do one step of a computation, have everyone wait for that to finish, and do the next step, which we need all the results from all, even from other threads, of the previous step available. And barriers support reuse like this. So each time we have a set of threads calling barrier wait, after the barrier triggers and barrier, you might say, falls, the other thread, all the threads are ready to go, and when they call barrier wait again, it triggers another round of the barrier waiting for all the threads to call wait. So we can just use the barrier over and over again. We don't need to initialize a separate barrier for each step. We just make one barrier and just use it repeatedly. Yes?
So is there some global variable keeping track of how many threads are finished waiting?
So the question is, there's some global variable keeping track of how many threads have finished waiting. So probably the implementation of the barrier object would have that counter in it. Yes. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Can you pick a set of threads to wait for instead of all of them? Not with the barrier interface. The barrier interface, you specify how many threads there are, and every time that many threads call wait, the barrier wait returns. So you can implement that sort of functionality of wait for particular threads, but we need a very different interface. Other questions? Okay, so pthreads has barriers called pthread barrier t's. There's an init which takes attributes, which we won't specify, but you can look up in the man page, and a number of threads. And then you can call pthread barrier wait to actually have the barrier do the wait operation. And you typically would call this from, you know, and if number of thread, whatever number of threads is, that many threads. So as an exercise, so let's say here I have code thread one and thread two. Let's say we run these simultaneously from two different threads. And before we run it, we initialize this barrier to have a thread count of two. And my question is, what is the output here? And I'll give you a little bit of time to work through that. Or if there's multiple possible outputs, what are the outputs? Who'd like some more time? Okay, any volunteers to give me one possible output? Yeah. 50 and 30. Okay. Any other possible outputs? Okay. So hopefully that's right. So let's work through this. So what I do to figure this out first is I say, okay, each of these barriers kind of has to match up with each other, right? Because the barrier weight waits for, in this case, two threads, because that's how we initialized it, to call barrier wait. So thread one's gonna call barrier wait. It's gonna be stalled until thread two calls it, or maybe it happens in the other order. But basically, these two calls to barrier wait are gonna be paired together. And both of them have to happen before either thread can go further. So what's gonna happen initially is at the time of this call here, we're going to have So I guess when we return from this call here, we're going to have x equals 20, y equals 10. Y equals 10 because, well, to get there, we had to have y equals 10 above at run, and nothing else changed y. And x equals 20 because in order to get there, the other thread had to get to barrier weight. To do that, it had to run x equals 20. Then after this barrier weight call, I'll do it in here, we have that matches up. That means that we ran this statement here. So we have x still equals 20 because nothing here changed it. And y equals 20 plus 10 ran. So y is now 30. Then immediately after the call to barrier, the third call to barrier weight, we know we're here, we're after the call, corresponding call in the other thread, so we ran this x equals x plus y, so we have x, the old value of x was 20, the old value of y is 30, so x equals 50, and y, nothing changed, so y is still 30. Some questions how I figured that out? Yeah. Question, does that end up being the only possible output? Yes. So our barriers in this case ensured mutual exclusion for access, for writing to x and y. So we have no, and reading from x and y. Or mutual exclusion. So only one thread wrote at a time. And if multiple threads read at a time, like there was no writes at the same time. So right, so yeah. So they assured that we had one possible outcome. It's definitely, if we weren't as careful with our barriers, like we would have you sort of multiple possible outcomes. Like if I remove one of the barriers from both calls, we wouldn't have that property anymore. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so as I mentioned, we have an upcoming life homework, and this is doing sort of Conway's so-called game of life. It's a zero player game really, so maybe not the right word. It's kind of like a sort of simulation where we have a grid of values and they represent, sort of conceptually represent cells that are dead or alive, and we have rules based on the surrounding cells about whether they become alive or go become dead or stay the same. And this means that kind of at each time step, we can compute the value at some location in the grid from the previous grid and our x and y coordinate. And what will actually happen is that, we'll have our grid and we will use the, if we're computing this value, we'll use the values, its old value and the values around it to compute it from the previous time step. And your assignment in the homework is going to be to produce different parts of the grid in different threads in order to speed this up, if we have multiple cores. And you need to synchronize that because we don't want one thread sort of thinking it's at time step 20 and reading values that another thread is computing, but that thread thinks it's at time step 10, because then you'll get the wrong values for the grid. So to avoid that, you're going to use barriers. Questions on sort of my very high level overview of the life homework. Okay. So we talked about barriers, and barriers are kind of this very special case synchronization construct. They deal with one pattern. Fortunately, it's a super common pattern, and therefore it's actually really useful in practice. But we'd like to have some more general constructs, and we're going to teach you a very, very general synchronization construct called monitors. And monitors are going to be something we get by combining a bunch of kind of building blocks, one of which we've learned about. So we're going to have a lock, and we're going to have this lock is going to protect some data structure. And by protect, I mean we're going to have a rule that whenever I access that data structure, I always acquire the lock first. I never touch the data structure. Don't even look at it without acquiring the lock. But we're going to add an additional tool called a condition variable, which is going to support waiting for something to become true about that data. I'm going to use the term condition variable for this because that's what everyone calls it back to the original literature. I think it is a horrible name. A condition variable represents a list of waiting threads. The reason it's called a condition variable is that typically all the threads will be waiting for the same thing, the same condition. But it's a list of waiting threads. It's just an abstraction of waiting threads. It doesn't know anything about what that condition is. That's all about how you use it. Just like a lock doesn't know what data structure it protects, that's all on how you use it. Same with a condition variable. The reason it's associated with a condition is how you use it. And the list of waiting threads is going to provide three operations, two of which are very similar. So we're going to have a wait operation, which is going to add the current thread to that list of waiting threads. And the way we'll use this is that when we're waiting for a particular condition to become true, we'll find the correct condition variable for that condition and call wait on it. And it also provides a signal or broadcast operation. And this is going to take that list of waiting threads and wake up some of them to tell them, hey, the condition you were waiting for is now true. And we're going to call the combination of a lock, some condition variables, and some data that these conditions are about, a monitor. And in the original kind of design for this, monitors were like represented as an object, as a programming language object. And in fact, the people who designed Java in the 90s were very enthusiastic about supporting monitors. So every object in Java is a monitor. It has a built-in lock and a built-in condition variable. And it has shared data, which is its instance variables. I'm not saying this is how you should do this type of synchronization in Java. Since the 90s, the people who designed the Java libraries have realized maybe we should provide a more nice library than the original version. But it was built into the language in Java. They thought it was that important. And that's kind of where the original design was in kind of the early implementations of this monitor idea. In C, it's not built into the language. So we're kind of building our own because we're going to be given the tools. We have locks. We can have shared data using global variables that multiple threads can access or structs multiple threads can access. And we'll have condition variables as an object through the pthreads library. So what our monitor is we're going to have our lock, that will acquire before accessing any of the stuff in the monitor. And, since we're like kind of thinking of this like an object, there's some operations that we're going to run that are internally going to acquire this lock, manipulate the shared data, manipulate the condition variables. We'll see some concrete examples of what those operations might be on a future slide. And a way we can think about locks is that when a lock is held by one thread, it's effectively holding a list of threads that are waiting for it. So it's one list of threads, and we're going to have some additional list of threads, which are these condition variables. So these condition variables each are going to have a list of threads that are waiting for something other than the lock. They're waiting for something else to happen. And that something else we're going to see is going to need to be something that's about this shared data. So something that needs to be true about this shared data. Again, we'll have specific examples of what that condition might be on some future slides. But basically, some function of the shared data, we're waiting for that to change. And our condition variable is going to have these three operations. We're going to have a wait operation. And this wait operation is going to take a condition variable and the lock. And the reason it's taking the lock is that, well, before we look at the shared data, before we check if we even need to wait, we need to acquire that lock. And if we unlock the lock, well, maybe we don't need to wait anymore, like immediately after we unlock it. So to avoid this issue, we're going to combine our unlock and wait, start waiting operation together. We're going to simultaneously, when we call wait, unlock the lock and start waiting. So there's no chance that it can change whether we need to start waiting or not until we actually start waiting. So when we call wait, we're going to add our current thread to one of those queues. And we're also going to unlock the lock, which means that we're going to remove a thread from the list of waiting threads, if there is any waiting, and let it start running. And wait before we return, it's going to relock the lock. So we'll see that later on when we look at how broadcast and signal work. That when wait returns, we get the lock back because, well, we want to do something with the shared data. We have this rule, we never look at the shared data without the lock. So we have a broadcast operation. And what that does is it's going to take all the threads that are listed in the condition variable, and it's going to remove them from the condition variables list and have them start getting the lock. So we can think of it as kind of moving all of them to the list of threads waiting for the lock. And that means that the next possible opportunity is, you know, whenever the lock is free, they'll start running and doing something with the shared data. There's also a signal operation, and what that will do is it's going to choose one of the threads that's waiting arbitrarily and let it run. Remove it from the list of waiting threads and put it, you know, have it acquire the lock when it can. So questions about our basic operations here before we actually apply these to an example? So we have our wait to add ourselves to a queue, and we have broadcast and signal to remove threads that waited from the queue. And these are going to be based on, you know, having a particular condition in mind. So to give an example here, I'm going to have two functions. So I have a wait for finish function. And the idea of the wait for finish function is that I can call this function from any number of threads. And if finish hasn't been called, it will wait until it is. If finish has already been called, it will just return immediately. And I can call finish. And when I call finish, that will take all the threads that are currently in wait for finish and make them return. And will also mean that future calls to wait for finish don't even bother waiting. So how do I implement this? Well, I have a monitor. So here's my monitor's data and condition variable and mutex. My mutex is this lock here. And I'm going to follow the rule that I'm never going to touch anything in this monitor without first locking that lock. And I have my shared data. My shared data is this one boolean, did I call finish yet? So it's initially going to be false. When we call finish, we're going to set it to true. And then I have a condition variable, which is for the list of threads that are waiting for finish to become true. So given that, and wait for finish, what do? I acquire the lock. I check if finished is true yet, and if it's not, I add myself to the list of threads waiting for it to be true. Now, something we do here that I'm going to explain later is after we get woken up from cond wait, we check again to see if finished really is true now. And if it is, then we return. You might wonder, do we really need to do that? The answer is yes, we'll discuss why. But there's something else going on which makes it so we have to double check. We can't just have an if statement. In finish, what I do is I acquire the lock. And I set finish to true, and then because I know there are threads that might be waiting for that to happen, I call con broadcast to have them all start running, and by start running, I mean try to acquire the lock and run. So they won't actually run until after I unlock the lock, but that's fine. So yeah, we'll talk about the loop. And notice that this con wait here, when we're waiting, one of the things I mentioned con wait does is it releases the lock. That's really important here, because if we don't release the lock, then the call to finish is gonna halt, gonna be deadlocked. And that would be pretty bad. So what can happen here? In kind of our typical case, is we call wait for finished, and then finish happens sometime later. Let's say in this very unlucky case, finish happens like right afterwards. That's fine. So finish starts waiting. We figure out, oh, it's not finished yet. We call con wait. We start waiting. We release the lock. So the finished thread can get the lock. It says finish to true. It broadcasts on the condition variable, and that makes us stop waiting on the condition variable's list of threads and start waiting on the lock's list of threads. Then finish unlocks the lock. That lets us go. We check the finish condition, finished variable again. We find out, oh, this time now it actually is true. We're done. We return. So that's one possible timeline. There's also some simpler timelines, like if the finish thread just runs first, it says finish to true. It calls con broadcast to take all the threads that are waiting on the condition variable and have them run. In this case, there's none of them, so easy. Then later on, we come along, we check, we get the lock, we check the finished variable, we find out, oh, it's true. So we don't even bother waiting, we just return, we're done. Questions about our simple wait for finished example? Like, this is our simplest use of monitors we'll have. Yeah?
Where does the unlock in the after-while?
So the question is, why do we have an unlock here if the condition wait unlocks it? So this relocks it, condition wait unlocks it while we're waiting and relocks it before we return. So that's why we need the unlock after. So even if this wasn't a loop, we still have the case where it's going to relock it for us. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And as for why does it relock it, well, the common case is that when the condition becomes true, we're going to maybe do something else other than just like check it. But there's another reason why, which is also why we have the loop, why we need to double check the condition. So let's talk about that. So it seems like in this special case, since we're not doing anything with finished after it becomes true, like we aren't like getting a value from the thread that finished or something like that. If we were doing that, then we probably want to require the lock to get that shared data, but we're not. It seems like, why do we need to recheck finished after waiting, which is what this while loop does. And we can find the answer in the pthread con wait manual page. It has this curious phrase, spurious wakeups may occur. What is a spurious wakeup? That is a polite way of saying that pthread con wait will return for no reason. And you might say, why would this happen? Why is this part of it? It turns out that it's a lot easier to make a fast implementation of pthread con wait if you allow this to happen very occasionally. And so that's what pthreads have done, and that's what pretty much every con wait implementation I know of in other programming languages has also done. And another reason this is going to be okay is that, as we'll see later, it turns out to be really hard to avoid double checking the condition and more complicated examples of using monitors. So in this simple case, if there were no spurious wakeups, we wouldn't need to worry. But in many real cases, there's going to be other reasons why we can be woken up, and something can happen after the broadcast call happens, but before we actually acquire the lock, that makes it so maybe we didn't want to be woken up really. And we'll see an example later. And in fact, we'll see an example on our next case where we're going to go through kind of a very common pattern with threads. So this is a nice common pattern. We're waiting for a thread to finish. You know, so we basically implemented pthread join in another way. So a more general common problem is the so-called producer-consumer problem. So in the producer-consumer problem, let's do here. The idea is we have several threads that are, we have a queue, a shared queue, and we have several threads that are adding to queue. And these are producers. And we have one of several threads that are removing from the queue. Remove from queue. And these are called consumers. And this is a very useful way to coordinate between threads. We'll have a bunch of threads produce values of some sort, and a bunch of threads consume them. Like an example might be if you have a web server, you might have a bunch of threads produce a list of pages to fetch into memory, and a bunch of threads that handle fetching those pages. So we'll have producer threads that are like taking requests from web browsers and putting them on this list, consumer threads that are actually like handling reading from disk or databases to do what those requests want. Might be an example. But this comes up all over the place when we're dealing with code. So it's like a really useful thing to have like special solutions for. So we'll look at how can we solve a producer-consumer problem with monitors. So here I have two functions. I have a produce function that adds something to a queue, and I have a consume function that remove something from a queue, but we have this special case where we need to wait. If the queue's empty, I don't just want a crash, don't want a null pointer exception. I want to wait for something to be on the queue and then return. And I want this to work where I might have multiple threads simultaneously calling consume and multiple threads simultaneously calling produce. And this is my solution with a monitor. So I have my monitor. I have, here's my monitor and its data and its lock and its condition variable. And I have a condition variable for the list of threads that are waiting in consume for data to be put on the queue. So when I have my usual thing about, you know, I'm never touching my shared data without acquiring the lock. So I don't, the shared data is the buffer, so I don't do anything with the buffer without having a lock. And I'll start with consume because I think it's usually easier to look at the waiters first. In consume, we acquire the lock so we can safely access the buffer without anyone else interfering. Then we check if the buffer's empty. If the buffer's empty, we wait. If the buffer's not empty, well, we just checked if the buffer's empty. We know even if we waited, we acquired the lock, went to the top of the while loop, checked if the buffer was empty. So we know if we've gotten to here, the buffer is not empty. And because we never released the lock, we know it's still not empty because no one can add something to the buffer while we have the lock. So then I dequeue something from the buffer and unlock. And my waiting is I'm waiting on this data ready condition variable. So I add myself to a list of threads waiting for data ready. And in produce, every time we add something to the queue, we wake up one thread from that list. And what if there's no threads waiting? Well, then it does nothing. And that's fine because, well, they'll figure out there's something on the queue when they try to actually to keep free. when they try to check if it's empty here, before they start. Okay, so questions about our condition variable and waiting code. Is there any sort of ordering for the threads that are waiting? In POSIX, there is not an explicit one. You might imagine that it would make sense for an implementation to like choose an order explicitly, but what they do actually varies. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's look at this loop here. This loop can run variable numbers of times. We'll talk about how it can run 0 iterations, 1 iterations, and 2 iterations. So 0 iterations is the case where we produce first, so the queue isn't empty, and then we call consume. That's a case where you'll go into consume, we'll check if the buffer's empty, find out it's not, we won't even bother waiting, we'll just dequeue and return. We can also have a simple case where we call consume, but we're ahead of the producer. So someone's adding stuff to the queue, they haven't done it yet. So what's gonna happen is we're gonna acquire the lock, we're gonna figure out, oh, the queue's empty, and we're gonna call conwait, which is gonna simultaneously unlock and start waiting. And our producer comes along later on, acquires the lock in queue, signals, which stops us from waiting, but we can't acquire the lock yet. And remember, conwait gets the lock before it returns. So then when the producer unlocks, then we get to go, we check if the queue's empty, it's not, we dequeue, unlock, and return. And I also have 2+ iterations. So one way we know we can have 2 iterations is if we have one of those nasty spurious wake-ups where just conwait decides, I'm gonna return even though no one calls signal or broadcast. But it turns out we can have conwait return and have us have to do another conwait call even without spurious wake-ups. To do this, we're going to need to have another thread involved. So let's say we have 2 consumers here. And we're going to focus on thread 2. That's the one that's going to have more than 2 iterations. So here, we lock it. We check if it's unlocked. We check if it's empty, sorry. Then we unlock and we start waiting. Then our producer comes along, and just like before, it causes us to stop waiting. Great. Then it unlocks the lock. And when it unlocks the lock, well, someone else is trying to get the lock, and they win. And this someone else is this other consuming thread, so it gets the lock first. Like, we're just in line for the lock, and we're second. That thread came first, and the way this lock apparently works is that it decided, the implementation has decided that this thread here gets the lock first, so it checks if it's empty, it's not, dequeues, unlocks, then we get the lock, we're next in line, we check if it's empty, and it is again, and we have to wait more. And we can have this happen over and over again, potentially. So there's actually no real limit to the number of times we can run this loop, even with no spurious wake-ups. So you might kind of legitimately say, wait a moment, why is this signal operation that's stopping us from waiting on this list of waiting threads and that we know we're going to have to reacquire a lock, why doesn't it make sure we get the lock first? Why does it have us wait behind this other thread? And that's a reasonable idea. This is actually a real proposed design called Hoar scheduling, after computer scientist Hoar, last name Hoar, and it is not what any implementation of condition variables that actually exists today does. Instead, rather than what Mr. Hoare came up with, we have Mesa-style monitors named after an early programming language called Mesa, where any eligible thread can get the lock. Doesn't matter which thread was woken up, any random thread can get the lock, there's no guarantees. So this means that you're gonna have to rely, you know, you're going to have to assume that you have to have this while loop. And this is why, even if we don't have spurious wakeups, you know, kind of in practice, we can't avoid having this while loop. So you should always do this while loop. You know, yes, sometimes it's just for spurious wakeups, but in more complicated scenarios, we need it anyways. And that's probably why the designers of pthread said, it's not worth avoiding spurious wakeups. People are going to need this while loop anyways. Why bother? So we have our kind of basics of monitors. Okay, yeah, let's go through this example here. So I'm going to take my producer-consumer, and here I had an unbounded queue. I can produce a million things, and then I'm buffering a million things. Something you might want to do is if we would have a million things in a buffer, maybe we should slow down the producers. So an idea we might have is that we'll have a bounded queue. Well, that the buffer can get full. And when the buffer is full, we'll have some thread that's calling produce wait for the buffer not to be full. So what I've done here is I said, well, we have a new reason we need to wait. So I'm going to make a condition variable for that, for the list of threads waiting for that reason. Waiting because the buffer is full and they need it to be emptied out a little bit. And I'm going to make sure that whenever I need to wait on that for that reason, I call cond wait on that condition variable, and I do so in a while loop where I always check after I wake up from waiting, is it actually not full anymore? And whenever I change whether I need to wait, I'm going to signal to wake up one thread because I've cleared up one slot in the queue, therefore one more thread can go. So that's why I'm calling signal. So that is my, you know, sort of addition of this. And this is a reason I like monitors, is that adding this new feature didn't involve like re-architecting everything. I can kind of do this piecemeal and add these new reasons to wait. Also, some things to note here. So I am saying my bounded queue has like a fixed size, so each time I remove something from it, I can add one more thing. If I didn't want to reason about how many things can go, it would be okay, in the sense of correct, for me to just broadcast and wake up everybody and having them figure it out. It would be slow, might we, you know. So in some cases, we'd say this is the wrong thing to do, but it's not going to make us have a race condition or a deadlock if we broadcast instead of signaling when we can't figure out like how many threads can actually call produce after this. If I didn't know, just make them all check. I have separate condition variables for these two different conditions. I can do a sloppy thing where I just say, rather than having separate condition variables for these two things, I'll just have one, and I'll just always broadcast and let them figure out which thing changed. You know, I'll just broadcast something changed about the buffer, you figure it out, and have a list of all threads waiting for something about the buffer. So I can do this sloppiness. This is slow, you shouldn't do it, but it means that there's this easy strategy of writing code that will at least be functional, you know, won't produce weird results. It will just be inefficient because you'll have lots of double checking for like the buffer being empty or full when we should know if we structure this code better that nothing really changed. So kind of our general pattern here is with a monitor, we're going to have a cond wait. So we're going to have we're going to lock, we're going to check a condition, we're going to wait for a condition variable corresponding to that, add ourselves to the list of waiting threads. Manipulate shared data, so like in produce we said like in queuing something on that shared buffer. Then we're going to, for each condition variable, we're going to say, did I change this? Did I change the thing the threads on that list are waiting for? If so, broadcast or maybe signal if we know only one thread cares that condition variable. So that's monitors. And kind of my rules of thumb here are, you know, things to emphasize is that, you know, we have monitors, we have the shared data, we never touch the shared data without the lock, and we hold the lock for the entire operation. So notice in all my examples, I checked if there was space on the buffer, and without releasing the lock at any point, then enqueued something. If I ever release the lock, that check is completely invalid and I need to redo it. And we have generally want to have a separate condition variable, separate list of waiting threads for everything we wait for. We always wait in a loop, especially because of spurious wakeups, but also because of sort of threads getting the lock kind of earlier than we expect, before us, even though we were broadcaster signal. We have to be very careful to call broadcaster signal whenever we change anything a thread is waiting for. If we don't do that, we'll have basically a deadlock. And we have these kind of shortcuts where we can like broadcast instead of signaling. If we aren't sure if we've changed something, we can just signal and it's slow, but like it's not gonna break something. Right, they're just gonna wake up, they're gonna go to their while loop and say, oh, nothing really changed, let's keep going. And just to show our condition variable SIG here, syntax. So questions on monitors before we do a little exercise? Okay, so let's do that. So here I'm gonna want to, I have this wait for both finished idea. So in this case, I've extended my finished idea. Instead of having one Boolean, I have two. 0 and 1. And my wait for both finish function, I want to call, and I want it to wait until not just finish is true, but both finish 0 and finish 1 are true. And we're gonna set one of the finish things to be true by calling finish with 0 or 1. So question is, what goes in our blanks here? So let's start with this one. What goes in the first while loop condition? Give you like a minute, you can check with your neighbor, see if you agree. Happened here. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, no clue? Okay, we have pretty good consensus on C, which is good. I know one of the reasons I do this exercise is because it's very easy to get confused and flip the condition. So just remember, be careful about that. How about here in our place where we're gonna wake up a thread potentially? What's the best thing to put there? And I mentioned that we can make some shortcuts, right? So if signal is valid, then broadcast would also be valid. It would just be inefficient, right? So I'm asking what's best, but it's possible that more than one of these would be functional, just not efficient. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E? No clue? Okay, so a lot of people like C. I think D is the best answer. So let's talk about, like, we kind of have two things going on. So one is, I think we have agreement not to do these. So here the problem is waking up threads when only one thread finished. One finished, right. So these first two, like, they'll be functional, but they'll wake up a thread even though we can tell from the finished array that it can't go yet. With the if statements, we're checking, oh, is the finish index I'm setting and the other one both true? If so, then let's wake up the thread, so I'm more sure it should be able to go. And the difference between the other two options is that basically C is saying only one waiting thread, one thread waiting, and B is potentially multiple threads waiting. And I didn't say, like, how many threads we could call wait for both finish, but if the idea is that, like, five different threads can all call wait for both finish, then we need to have a broadcast. And that seems to be the more flexible thing, so that's what I would say is the better thing to do. If we had a restriction that only one thread is allowed to call wait for both finished, then signal would be okay. Questions? Okay. And I'll just go through this quickly. So we talked about barriers. So we can implement barriers with monitors and condition variables. So we'll talk about implementing a one-use barrier. So real barriers are multi-use, require some extra bookkeeping. But a one-use barrier, well, what can we do? Well, we can keep track of shared state. What's our shared state going to be? How many threads have reached the barrier? And we acquire a lock before we touch that shared state. We check how many threads actually reach the barrier. And if the number of threads that reach the barrier is equal to the total number for the barrier, then we can broadcast to wake everyone who's waiting. And we have this condition variable, which is the list of threads waiting for everyone to reach the barrier. So if not everyone's reached the barrier, we just wait until that's true. So this is like an example of how we could implement barriers, except I'm missing the piece where the barriers were usable. So that would be some extra stuff I need to add, but we can actually use monitors to implement barriers if we want to do that. You know, it just takes a little extra work to handle the issue of reusing the barrier. Okay, so questions about our monitor examples? Okay, so I'm going to briefly mention semaphores and then talk a little about false sharing. So monitors let you implement pretty much any way of coordinating multiple threads, and they're not the only tool which does that. Another tool that's very common out there we want you to know about, but we're not going to teach in nearly as much detail, is called semaphores. And a semaphore is a counter, basically. But rather than kind of accessing the counter directly, we're going to use an up or down operation. These also have some other names, like wait or signal or post, because people have done all sorts of versions of monitors, and also some original names in Dutch, because this is one of the things Dijkstra did. So the down operation is going to decrement the counter. The up operation is going to increment it. But we have this special rule that the count can't become negative. So if the count would become negative, instead we're going to wait until it won't. So when we decrement it, if it's already zero, we're just going to wait until someone calls up to increment it before we let the decrement actually happen. So it's like an integer. We're never going to read or write it directly. We're always going to use these up or down operations And it never becomes negative. If it becomes negative, we wait. And as for why is this a useful idea, well, we can kind of give an example with, let's say we're tracking like a library book. So we have a like three copies of a library book. We can represent the kind of coordination this means with a semaphore, that we're going to have a semaphore, which is a counter for the number of copies of that book that are free. And reserving a copy is calling the down operation. We're decrementing the number, but if it's zero, when I want to reserve a copy, I have to wait for the copy to be free first. And when we return a copy, that's the up operation. We have to know when we return a copy, if someone's waiting for it, we have to assign the copy to them. So this semaphore counter abstraction kind of matches this intuitive sort of counting the number of things idea that are free. You know, and down is reserving one of those free things, up is returning them. So we can think of, you know, that we think of our library book scenario, we have our three copies. You know, if we take out one, you know, our counter operations we call down, we decrement the free count from three to two. You know, and if that's done three times, our count is now zero. So if I try to reserve another copy, I'm going to decrement the counter, and that's going to cause me to wait until someone returns one. Then when someone returns a copy, you know, I'll finish waiting and they'll release me from that condition. So that's the basics of semaphores. I don't think semaphores are the better abstraction than monitors. Not everyone agrees with this. I think monitors are generally more intuitive. But everything you can do with monitors, you can do with semaphores and vice versa. And obviously, the easiest way to prove this is I can implement monitors, locks, and conditioned variables with semaphores, and I can implement semaphores with monitors. So they're equally powerful. And I would recommend monitors because I think they're a lot more intuitive and less error-prone, but there's, you know, definitely things to like about semaphores, like spurious wake-ups aren't a thing with semaphores. So questions about semaphores? Here. Okay. So one last topic, so switching gears. So we've talked about sort of coordinating threads, and so far we've kind of acted as if, you know, as long as our threads are accessing different things, you know, we don't need to coordinate. Our coordination's all when we're actually sharing something. But there's a problem we're gonna call full sharing, which has to do with how things that are conceptually different are actually implemented. And the problem comes from if we have one cache block, and let's say I have a value for thread one's value and thread two's value, both in the same cache block. And if we're running these on two different cores, then on one core, we're gonna have, you know, one's core. We're going to have a modified version of that. And on another core, it's going to have a differently modified version of that cache block. And there's a question of like, well, how does that work? If they both modify the cache block, how do we coordinate that? And the answer that most hardware has chosen is that we don't allow both of them to do this at the same time. That the hardware is going to have something like locking going on internally to coordinate writes to the cache block. Meaning that thread one is going to take turns with thread two in modifying the cache block. That when thread one modifies the cache block, if thread two wants to modify it, it's going to have to make thread one take its value and write it to memory so thread two can modify the cache block and have the, without losing the prior modifications. Because remember, when we do our dirty bit, we don't track, I only modified this part of the cache block. I just say, it's modified. So I have no way of really reconciling that, you know, core one modified the first byte for 2 modify the second. They don't have that information. They just know it's modified. So the way they handle this is that when I start modifying it, I make sure I get everyone else's modifications first. And if you start modify it again, you need to get my modifications before you can add yours in. So this means that when we have two values in the same cache block and we're writing to them, even though they're conceptually completely separate values, we can notice this locking happening in the internal implementation because it's going to affect our performance. That they have to move the cache block around a lot more than they normally would. You know, basically we're not taking advantage of caching anymore, because rather than having that nice idea of, you know, if I modify a value a lot in a write back cache, it doesn't go to the next level. Well, that's not true anymore, right? It has to go to the next level to coordinate with the other cache. And we can observe this empirically. So here I have a function called sumup that into stardest, sums up a 64 megabyte array, a 64 million element array. And I'm going to call this from two different threads, where the dest I pass it is at the beginning of this array dest or some offset into it. And for small offsets, those two values are going to be in the same cache block. For large offsets, they aren't. And that has a big effect. So here I have this code, so I'm just calling the sumup function twice with, you know, index 0 in the array and index distance, where I vary distance. And when that distance trips over 64 bytes, which is my cache block size, I notice a big difference. So below a 64 byte difference, I see that I have much slower performance, because what's happening is the cache block's going from one core's cache to the others, back and forth, rather than staying in one core until we're done with the whole sum. Once I get above 64 bytes, these are two different cache blocks, so they have no interference performance-wise with each other. Questions on the results I have here? Like why we're seeing this big performance difference here? Comments? Okay. So this problem is known as false sharing. So basically, we have two things that are actually independent, but because of kind of the internals of the implementation, the accesses to them end up getting synchronized. And how can we solve this problem? Well, you know, if this is a performance issue we have, we can deliberately make sure the two values are in different cache blocks. So let's apply this. So here I have some code that looks pretty similar to stuff we saw earlier. Where is there likely to be a false sharing in here? And how could we fix it? Any suggestions on places we are likely to have false sharing in this code? Yeah, so results 0 and 1 is, I think, a likely place, right? Because we don't know for sure that these are in the same cache block, but They're likely to be because they're in the same array and they're adjacent elements in the array. Maybe the array is at the edge of a cache block. Maybe it's not, but probably most of the time they're in the same cache block. And if we have the most straightforward way of compiling this code, we're doing lots of writes to that cache block over and over again, and they're going to have to take turns in the hardware. And I think that's basically the only place where we're likely to have false sharing here. So something that can be confusing is, like, you might say, oh, wait a moment. Aren't we accessing values 511 here and values 512 here? And the answer is yes. But I think there's two reasons why that shouldn't result in false sharing. So one reason is it's only reads. So for false sharing, we generally need writes. Processors can actually have two caches cache things read-only simultaneously. That's no problem. It's when one of them's writing that we have a problem. Because the writes need to take turns, the reads don't. So writes need to take turns with other writes and with reads, but not with, you know, two reads we can do at the same time. The other reason why is that if these are running at roughly the same time, we're accessing values of 511 last and values of 512 first, so they're likely to be spread apart in time, even if they were in the same cache block. And even if we were writing, that would be less likely to be an issue. As for how can we mitigate this issue, well, there's a couple things we could imagine doing. So one is something the compiler probably does, which is that if the way we actually compile this code is that we have a temp register and we increment in the temp register and then assign that to results of zero, which is probably something our compiler will do if we enable enough optimizations for code that's this simple, but maybe not for a more complicated case. Well, then that is going to make the false sharing a lot better because we're only going to have one write. There's only one possible time the value can kind of ping pong back and forth, especially if we do that in both cases. Another way we can mitigate that is that we could say, instead of having results of two, we could have results of 1,000 and make this be results of zero and this be results of 999. We actually don't need such a big number, but deliberately spread them apart in memory, right? So we're sure they're not in the same cache block. If we wanted to do this optimally, we'd figure out how long or big is a cache block and separate them by exactly that amount. Typically, this is not something you worry about in your code. But what you would think about is you would think about, oh, if I'm writing to things, I want to write to like big contiguous sections of things. Like I want to try to use the whole cache block. I don't want to like use multiple parts of the same cache block from different threads if I'm doing, you know, if I have better choices that don't do that easily. And so you won't like do this idea, though like if you look at, for example, the Linux kernel, they have places where they like deliberately lay things out. So they like say, we're gonna order this struct so these fields are in one cache block and these other fields are in a different cache block because we know they're accessed on different cores. And they just usually do it by just saying, you know, we're just changing the order of things in the struct to put all the things for one thread together, all the things for another thread together. And that sort of general idea is basically a good practice anyways, as far as like spatial locality goes. Okay. So that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we might talk a little bit more about synchronization and then we'll move on to networking.